broadcasting statewide on the Golf Club Network, it's the Golf Club Radio Show with Danielle Tucker.
Hey, welcome in. You're in the clubhouse. It's August 17th. It's Solheim Cup. Yes, the action is awesome. You got to watch Golf Channel. Watch it right now while you're listening to the show. Ron Cyrak, journalist, executive editor, Golf World, senior writer, Golf Digest, author of Vision 54, Trilogy, and ecstatic Pittsburgh Pirates fan. He'll be with us next. But first, let's thank the people who make this show possible.
The Golf Club, brought to you by Acura of Honolulu. Now more than ever, choosing an Acura just makes sense. With this much traffic, you should ride in comfort. Introducing the Acura RLX and RLX Advance. Poipu Bay Golf Course, 18 championship holes, visually stunning. Nature and Robert Trent Jones Jr. conspired to create a stunning venue for golfers of all abilities. A unique and unforgettable golf experience. Poipu Bay Golf Course, Kauai's South Shore Jam. And Star Protection. Get your property threat and risk assessment, then protection for your home or business, for your concert or special event, like the Hyundai Tournament of Champions. Get the Star Team on your property. Star Protection is what you need in Hawaii and California.
And, wow, the highs and lows of this week, amazing. Ron Cyrak joins us this morning. Welcome to the show, Ron. It's a shame I can't hear him.
Hello, can you hear me?
No, I can't. It's great to have you on. You have had a great week on Golf Channel, Morning Drive, Golf Central. Great job, by the way, getting everybody ready for Solheim Cup underway now in Colorado. It's amazing watching this on television. It must be amazing being there.
Yeah, first off, it's a great golf course. I'm really impressed with it. It's got a very linksy kind of feel to it. And then it's a great event. It's got an atmosphere that's sort of a cross between a college football game and Halloween, you know, with a lot of singing and chanting and people dressed up. And we're seeing some really good golf. And what's fun about match play is sometimes you don't necessarily need great golf to have a great match, you know, because two people can go out there and shoot 74 against each other and it'd be a very good match.
Absolutely. It's do or die, kind of like on the PGA Tour this weekend for a lot of guys. It's do or die at Solheim Cup, every hole, every shot. It's just been interesting to watch this very exciting event. But before we get to the on-course drama, can we talk a little bit about the hazards drama we had yesterday and that 30-minute kind of lost segment we were watching yesterday with that ruling that happened? I think it was Rule 26-1C that turned out to be a wrong ruling.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. It's a situation not all that dissimilar from what we went through with Tiger Woods at the Masters on his bad drop situation, where essentially there are multiple options to take relief after a penalty. And sort of what they did here is combined two options into one, and it ended up being a wrong drop. She was going to opposite margin from the hazard relief, so she should have been able to take two club lengths and then play from there. Instead, she took the behind in between option, which means you can go back as far as you want. So, strangely, though, I mean, it's this odd situation where she went back 40 yards.
Yeah.
So adding 40 yards to a shot is not really gaining a whole lot of an advantage. And then I don't know if you saw the drop that she took. She ended up with a horrible lie on hard pan with a ball above her feet. And while the rules official made a mistake, and there's no question about it, but let's not lose sight of the fact that Carlotta Singanda, who was chopping it up horribly in
yes,
that match,
yes,
then makes an up and down from about 170 yards.
Yes, it was amazing. On 15, she couldn't hit a fairway for her life yesterday. And Suzanne Pedersen was amazing. I mean, watching her play, she basically could have done that by herself. She kind of pulled Carlotta along with her. This rule is 26-1, and they used number C, from what I understand, as an additional options available only if the ball crossed the margin of the lateral water hazard, drop a ball outside the water hazard within two club lengths of and not nearer the hole than one, the point where the original ball last crossed the margin of the water hazard, or a point on the opposite margin of the water hazard, equidistant from the hole. And when proceeding under this rule, the player may lift and clean his ball or substitute a ball. So here we go. There's the rule. Now, what I found interesting is watching it, it seemed like everybody didn't, the rules officials didn't, it didn't feel like they really knew what they were doing. They were using the laser to get the distance. And that triggered a reaction from Stacey Lewis, who was not having a good day yesterday, and she was showing it in her game, in her mood, and she went, but after the round, after the hole that they were playing, after the day ended, she then complained to the rules officials that she didn't like the ruling. She thought there was something terribly wrong. What should she have done?
Well, see, this is, there's a difference between complaining and filing a complaint. And the and you have to file official complaint of a ruling before the, you tee off on the next hole. And the Americans didn't do that. And Meg Mallon admitted that. And when it came to the end of the day yesterday, and we were here for just an awful long time because Lotta Neumann and Meg had a lengthy meeting before they came in to talk to us. By the time Meg came in to talk to us, the only thing that she was annoyed about was that it took 27 minutes to make the decision.
Yeah.
Remember, this group was the first group, so they backed up the next three groups. And Meg said, my team lost momentum, and that's a valid point. It's hard to fathom why it took 27 minutes to reach a decision.
Which is why I called it like a segment from Lost, the television show. It looked like they were absolutely not anywhere near where they were supposed to be. What about the laser? Using the laser to determine yardage, that I understood, but why tell everybody the distance? That seemed to really upset Stacey.
Yeah, and I think Stacey's wrong on this, because the distance is information. Information is allowed to be exchanged. Advice is not allowed to be exchanged. So there wasn't really anything. They were gaining information in order to give themselves a better opportunity to make the correct decision. And that's all okay. That's all fine within the rules.
Okay.
And Stacey, I mean, I think you hit the nail right on the head. Stacey was reacting like somebody who was in the process of losing her second point in the day and going to 1-5 overall in Solheim Cup play.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to continue on to a point that you were at the, was it San Diego, the rules meeting that the USGA held in San Diego in January of this year?
Yeah, at the annual meeting.
Right, at the annual meeting. So, you know, Ron Cyrak, executive editor of Golf World, Golf Digest, he is among rules officials all the time, and he goes to all of the events. He's very savvy when it comes to all of these things. And I, frankly, Ron, reading in Golf World the article that Bill Fields wrote on simplifying the rules of golf, and I'm going to have John Morissette on the show, David Hayes, a member of the USGA Rules Department, 2003 to 2009, and John Morissette, he was on the USGA Rules Department staff for 17 years. They've come up with something interesting, those two codes, one based on the rules of golf, one that, in code number two, is dramatically different, and they seem to prefer the dramatically different. What do you think? I mean, being so close with the rules officials, what do they think? What do you think of changing the rules and making them simpler?
You know, I don't think the rules are overly complex. I am stunned that there are so many people, so many players who don't know the rules. And I think that players, and probably even more importantly than players, caddies, because sometimes they have the coolest heads out there, should have to go to rules school and should be well versed in them. Something like how to take relief from a hazard shouldn't be all that complicated. I think it was made a little bit more complicated yesterday by the fact that it was a massively large hazard over there that they were trying to figure out how to negotiate. But, you know, it's, as one rules official said to me yesterday, there were two kinds of rules officials.
Yes.
One who's made a mistake and one who's going to make a mistake.
Right,
it happens. It just happens.
Yeah, of course. Okay, now, let's talk a little bit about Michelle Wee. And I frankly, you know, I root for the game, the story. There are times personally when I see something happen to someone who's taken a lot of heat, a lot of guff, a lot of tomatoes being thrown at her, rotten ones. Michelle Wee, I was very happy for that young lady yesterday, and I still feel this need for people just to wait for her to fall down and get that bucket of rotten tomatoes and throw them at her as soon as she starts making mistakes. But she really came off strong.
Michelle's a lot like Tiger Woods in that people are either pro or against, you know, and there are very few people who are neutral on it. There are some who think that she's been you know, overly hyped and her performance doesn't live up to that, and some people thought that's why she got the captain's pick. I defended the captain's pick from the beginning because I thought it was three people for two spots: Michelle Wee, Jarena Pillar, and Jennifer Johnson. And both Johnson and Pillar would be Solheim Cup rookies. And with Lizette Salas, Jessica Korda, and Lexi Thompson already on the team as Solheim Cup rookies, I didn't think Meg would pick two rookies. And Michelle, even though she's only 23 years old, this is her third Solheim Cup. You could argue that she's played some of her best golf in the Solheim Cup.
Absolutely.
I think the format and the atmosphere frees her up to play more like kid, and that she does perform well here. I'm sure if you saw me on Morning Drive this week, I told Charlie Reimer on Thursday morning that she was going to surprise him, that she was going to play well here, and I believe that. I think it was the right pick, and I think she's proven it was the right pick.
Absolutely. I think we discussed this last week when we talked about the experience means all, and to the rookies, it's huge. Lizette Salas, such a strong player, and this is her first time, and it really shows the nerves come out. You know, Jessica Korda lost her breakfast watching. She said it was more stressful for her watching her Morgan Pressel, right? And then all of a sudden she finds herself not holding the banana down that she had, you know? I mean, this is a lot of stress, a lot of tension that some of the gals don't even realize it until they're on the course and they have to tee off. And that's the exciting. Now, I thought that the Michelle Wee, Christy Kerr pairing was fabulous. They just know how, they've got the same kind of gutsy attitude when they get down and fighting for Team USA. The Brittany Lang Michelle Wee combo kind of confused me. Can you explain that?
I don't know how to explain that. You know, I mean, I don't think it's certainly doesn't make sense to me the way that Wee Kerr won in 2011 at Killeen Castle paired together. It could be that what Meg is thinking is that Michelle, who's more emotional than Brittany Lang, will light a fire under her and maybe get her going. And you see pairings like that sometimes, like Pressel and Creamer and Wee are the kind of emotional players that you might pair with somebody who's more low-keyed in the hope that you get them psyched up for the event.
Okay, we started today 5 Europe, 3 United States. Right now, it looks like we're leading in 3 events, 3 matches rather, with Morgan Pressel and Jessica Korda holding on against Anna Nordqvist and Caroline Hedwall. Wow, those two are really strong. Anna Nordqvist doesn't look like she's phased one bit. She's just stripes it right down the fairway. Just amazing. Who's impressed you?
Yeah, I think that Nordqvist is somebody who's making a statement that she's ready to step up. I mean, this is a transition team for Europe. They have 6 rookies on it and 3 other players who have only played in 1 Solheim Cup. And Nordqvist is making a statement that she's willing to step up to be amongst that next generation of leaders on the European team. She, again, is very, very good. Somebody described her as, you know, she's 6 feet tall, and somebody said, oh, they've supersized Annika, you know, and she sort of does play that way, you know. She's a fairways and greens kind of person, just like Annika was. The Nordqvist-Hedwall pairing is turning out to be a very, very strong pairing. And Hedwall emerged in the last Solheim Cup at Killeen Castle as a really top player. She was one of those players in the final four groups who led that surge when Europe won 3.5 the final 4 points to win.
Yeah, and it's a great European main. You brought this up on Morning Drive, the mainland Europe, so to speak, where the UK used to be dominant. Now we've got Spain and Germany and everybody is represented. It's really great to see that on this European team, and it's kind of Katrina Mathieu is confused probably just as much as I am about the state of her game right now.
Yeah, Katrina didn't play badly, but but didn't play quite as well as I thought. And she is a very, very good Solheim Cup player. But, you know, to build on your point about players from the continent, I thought one of the key matches yesterday was Apahara Munoz and Kareen Isher beating Christy Kerr and Paula Creamer in foursomes. When I saw the pairings come out, I thought, okay, this is going to be 2-2. And but it ended up being 3-1. And Munoz Isher beat Kerr Creamer 2-1, but it was a lot easier than that. They were up 4-0 at one point. And you know, you got those are players from Spain and from France, and and that's again, that speaks well for the growth of the game. The game is growing on the continent. And remember, the next Solheim Cup, we're going to Germany to play.
Yes. Really excited about that. All right, we've got what's happened right now. Interesting. Stacey Lewis and Paula Creamer were 4-0 on Asahara Munoz and Kareen Isher, and now it's 1-1. So, and there are three matches where it's 1-1. One is all square. We can't count Europe out. Who has impressed you on the U.S. team?
First off, you know, I love the ebb and flow of the momentum in match play. It can change so quickly. You know, you could be 4-0. And you lose two holes, and all of a sudden you're still 2-0, but you're thinking like you're 2-down, you know, because all of a sudden the momentum shifted.
Yes.
Pressel and Cord have played very, very well yesterday, and I think that they impressed me a lot. I thought that you had a couple of players who had a little bit of problem with the putter, and Lexi is one of those, but. Right now, I'm impressed with how Stacy is bouncing back from yesterday. And, you know, Christy is Christy. I mean, you know, Christy Kerr is she's a hard person sometimes to embrace. I once wrote about her that you can get to know Christy Kerr, but it's like playing catch with a cactus. You know, it comes with a price.
I saw that.
But she is unquestionably the best American player of her generation. She's in her mid-30s, she's got 16 wins and 2 major championships, and she's not short on fire. And one of the reasons that we get paired with her is Christy's a very hard person to pair with because she's Tiger Woods-like in that she's in a zone of isolation out there. She doesn't really want a partner. She wants to do this by herself. And Michelle's one of the people who can, like, you know, sort of joke around with her and bond with her in a way that some of the other players can't.
I like the pairing because Christy Kerr can putt, and we can't count always on Michelle Wee. Michelle Wee is amazing from the bunker. She's amazing, her short game, but when she gets on those greens, man, you know, it's a tough one. It really is. I think Morgan Pressel is probably one of the most underrated of our match play players. She is really good.
Well, she's 3-0 in singles in Solheim Cup play, and she won the U.S. Women's Amateur in match play. You know, she does what serves her very well in match play is she keeps her golf ball out of trouble. You know, and she's a very, very good. She's always been good in USGA events where keeping your ball out of trouble is the key, and she's got that. She's just got a really good feisty attitude about it. And you're absolutely right about Christy Kerr. She's probably the best putter among the Americans. And here's what I've seen different in Michelle Wee's putting right now, which is, though I'm not a fan of the stance that she's using, she's not three-putting as much. She's not making a lot of putts, but she's not three-putting. And so that's sort of an improvement for her. She still misses way too many putts, but the cutting down on the number of three putts is a step forward for her.
I think she's gone from being in the low 100, I mean 100 and plus, making putts to something like in the top 50, which is a big improvement, right? I mean, that's great.
Sure. I mean, I'm a big believer that great putters are born, they're not made. But you can take a bad putter and make a bad putter adequate or better than adequate. Annika Sorenstam was not a natural feel putter, and in 1999 she had the ifs and she couldn't make a three footer, and she fixed that, and she never became a great putter, but she became a reliable putter, particularly making those six footers under pressure. And Michelle could get to that point. She's never going to be Tiger Woods. She's never going to be Christy Kerr with a putter because that feel is something you're born with in your hands. But she can be a lot better than she is.
We're talking with Ron Cyrak, Golf World Executive Editor, Senior Writer for Golf Digest. Great to see your Pirates on top. It's just awesome. I'm so happy for you. And what about this course? This is the first time we've been this far west doing a Solheim Cup. Do you like it out west? Do you think it's better on the East Coast?
Well, I like this course a lot. It's a Ben Crenshaw, Bobby Core design, and the greens are very fast and have a lot of undulation to them, and they're very linksy. If you notice, a lot of shots are played in, and you got to play to the slope. And they are very challenging greens without being overly goofy, you know, without having two tiers, three tiers, and it's more that they got a lot of subtle slopes to them. And I've seen so many shots play in and say, wow, that's going to be way out to the right, and then it just catches the slope and starts to feed to the hole. The kind of the greens that require you to be imaginative and be a shot maker.
Some of the hole placements today the pin placements are just amazing. There's one, I don't know which hole it is because I was kind of in a hurry this morning, but it's like if you miss it, it's going to run right off the green and straight down a gorge. It's tricky
stuff.
Yeah,
there were a couple yesterday that I thought, like on 17, the par 3, I don't know how you could get the ball close to the hole. You know, it seemed like 20 feet was the best you were going to do, no matter how great of a shot that you hit. But that had a lot to do with green speed. Look, these greens probably started the week putting 11 and 11 and a half, and they're probably going faster than that now. And except for the possibility of a U.S. Open, these players don't putt greens at that speed.
Well, it's great talking with you. Quite the journey. Your next stop is Deutsche Bank. I hope you can join me during that. It's been like a journey of the magic, you know, of golf. It's been fantastic.
I've been to some cool places. I've been to Muirfield and St. Andrews and Oak Hill and now Colorado Golf Club with a little side trip to do morning drive in between.
Yeah. So can we talk from Deutsche Bank?
You got it.
Excellent. Anytime. Thank you very much. Bye. Always a pleasure talking with Ron Cyrak, Golf World Executive Editor, Senior Writer for Golf Digest. Travel safe, sir. We'll be back right after this. My name is Danielle Tucker, and this is The Golf Club.
Stay tuned. We'll be hitting the greens with Danielle Tucker when we return to the Golf Club. Star Protection Agency, providing security across Hawaii since 1991. Licensed and bonded. Property guard and patrol services. Loss prevention. Star Protection provides the security you need with the industry-leading internet-based reporting system. One call does it all. 532-3911. Or on the web at starprotectionagency.com. Star Protection, locally owned with people you trust. It was our office manager's birthday, and she loves golf. So we decided to get together for golf at Poipu Bay, and we invited a bunch of our customers. It turned into a party. The clubhouse restaurant made a fabulous lunch. The customers had a great time and met the people they give orders to. They were golf buddies long before the 19th hole. Golf at Poipu Bay. Family, friends, business, and fun at Poipu Bay Golf Course on Kauai's South Shore. Spectacular. Call 742-8711 and book your tee time, get together, or event at Poipu Bay. That's 742-8711. Poipu Bay Golf Course, Kauai's South Shore Gem.
The new Acura RDX features an incredibly efficient V6 engine with 273 horsepower. Yet the RDX has incredible nimble driving characteristics. And let's not forget, it's also equipped with standard power moonroof, Bluetooth phone connectivity, and a 360-watt 7-speaker premium audio system. It also has standard leather seats. Unfortunately, they don't make any sound. Test drive the new RDX today.
Visit your local Acura dealer today. Luxury, intelligently priced.
The new Acura RLX's true sense of luxury comes from its unique technologies. From the Juuleye LED headlights and precision all-wheel steer, to its available 14-speaker Krell premium audio system, the RLX takes everything you love about a luxury sedan and makes it even more luxurious. The all-new RLX from Acura. Luxury taken to a whole new level.
Visit your local Acura dealer today. Luxury, intelligently priced.
Let's see, 40 yards to the pin, wind in my face. Where's my wedge? I saw this flop shot on TV. Oh, not even close. Now, back to Danielle Tucker.
Oh, welcome back in the clubhouse. Now, freelance golf journalist, I've got to tell you about Matt Cooper. Okay, he's a golf and feature writer. His features cover everything from golf technology to golf travel, a contributor to Sky Sports, a ghostwriter for European Tour player Chris Wood, contributor to SportingLife.com, and I love this one the most, a golf tipster for bettingzone.co.uk. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Hello, Danielle. How are you?
I'm excellent. It's good to have you on. Now, are we going to talk, like, you know, when you're covering an event, you're supposed to be completely impartial, as they say, when you're writing, right? You're supposed to write the best story. So are you talking to me as Matt Cooper, the writer, or are you talking to me as Matt Cooper, the European Tour, or European team fan?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
I just caught the end of you talking to Ron Tyrak. And he did a very good tweet a couple of days ago, or maybe last night, when a Twitter follower of his responded to some tweets that he put out asking, was he European or American?
Right.
And Ron replied, I'm a journalist.
I'm a journalist, which is why I introduced him this morning as journalist, because indeed, you know, I'm a journalist, and that's why you have to be impartial. But everybody has their favorites. I don't care, you know, you
that's
can't,
true.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, people walk around being all integrity, but in real life, it's not necessarily the case. So,
of course, yeah. Right? I think probably the way I look at it is I probably irritate a lot of my friends quite a lot because I find it quite easy to be impartial. And I don't, I think the whole notion of being European is quite peculiar because if I asked you to get together as North and South America, I'm not quite sure how you would feel an affinity with people from Chile or whatever.
No, in the same sort of way,
the European sort of team ethic is quite contrived, and it's always very funny. It's less the case during the Solheim Cup, but definitely the case during the Ryder Cup, that an awful lot of British golf club members get incredibly European and very proud of their European heritage when they spend sort of 52 plus 51 weeks of every 2 years disliking Europe with an absolute passion. So it's quite a sort of contrived notion but at the same time, I am actually I'm probably more European than most British people are. And yet at the same time, I was actually disappointed yesterday that Paula Creamer didn't play as she did in 2011, because when I was at Killeen Castle, her performance was, apart from the conclusion when Europe was so superb, her passion and ability to hold putts when they mattered is the standout feature for me of that event. And yesterday she seemed quite flat, and it was a bit of a disappointment.
Yes,
so I'm able to look at it that way. But at the same time, I mean, you may also be alluding to the fact that I sent a tweet to Aston Monos at the start of this week. And I did say, oh, you know, my professional impartiality, / we'll be cheering you on, we'll be going on this week. And so that's so much. Yeah, but it's in that case, it tends to be things like I played the Irish Open Pro-Am in 2011 with Asa, and we chatted about the fact that we were playing the course that the Solheim Cup would be played on. You spend 5 hours in somebody's company and you get to know them quite well. And I knew how desperately she wanted to play that event, and it wasn't sure that she would qualify, and she was quite nervous that she didn't want to hope that she was in and then have her hopes dashed. And eventually she did make it, and she did play superbly. So I know how much the event means to her. Anna Nordqvist is another I've spent a lot of time with at events, and know how much the event means to her. So it's very easy to sort of root for those people. So it's almost I'm rooting for them as people as much as for Europe.
I just need to interject that I get myself in a lot of trouble when I go to a sporting event because I tend to root for the play. And if I see an excellent play, it doesn't matter which team they're on, I'm like, wow, did you see that? And if I'm sitting in the wrong spot, I can get in a lot of trouble. You know what I'm saying? And when you talk about Europe and playing as a European team, all you have to do is know a little bit about football and know that Germany and England are, you know, or France and any of those countries are far from united when it comes to the competition between football, you know? I mean, it gets, just cities, you know, in England, so areas. Yes, so let's talk a little bit about, from your view, from how much of the Solheim Cup are you seeing? We're seeing lots of it on Golf Channel. There, I mean, from 12 hours yesterday. Are you getting that kind of coverage in the UK?
Yes, Sky Sports has got it on their channels, so we're able to watch everything. And in terms of wider within Europe, the Ladies European Tour have actually been able to get it on YouTube. So anybody in any, I think actually, I was looking at the list of countries that can actually watch it for free on YouTube, and it's quite extraordinary. It's pretty much anywhere around the world, apart from probably the United States and Great Britain, where you have to have either Golf Channel or Sky Sports, but pretty much everywhere else can watch it for free on YouTube.
It's fantastic. We're going to be talking with Steve Mona about the economic, you know, things that happen for a place. Look at the coverage that Colorado is getting around the world. Hawaii always loves it when an event is played here because we're broadcast worldwide. It's same thing for Ireland. I think Ireland made $50 million. It was just for having the Solheim Cup there. I'm not sure what Colorado is going to benefit, how the benefit will be. And we'll get that from Steve. Tell me what you thought about the rules situation, what you think about the play. What sticks out for you as you talk to me? What do you want to communicate about this event?
Well, I always tend to take a little bit of a sort of contrary view to these sort of things. Everybody gets very het up when these things happen, and yesterday, actually, a couple of things happened prior to the big fuss on the 15th, and it kind of indicated to me that had the roles been reversed a little bit, the Europeans would have been just as frustrated as the Americans were, which tends to be typical of what happens with these sorts of problems in sport. That, for instance, there was one thing at one point when Christy Kerr's caddy cleaned a ball, and a lot of European supporters and European LET golfers actually were on Twitter going, well, that's not allowed, that's terrible. Well, I think it actually emerged that it was perfectly okay because it had to be marked because another ball had to be played. And in actual fact, the rules allowed that in those circumstances the ball could be cleaned. So there was a lot of fuss over, and people were getting very irate about that. And then the same people were very quiet when the Europeans got a very favourable ruling. And of course, it took so much time. Now, in actual fact, I've had them contact me on Twitter and go, well, the Americans are getting so upset about what happened on 15. What happened with Christy Kerr? Well, that more or less confirms to me that if they can get so upset about a relatively minor thing with her cleaning the ball, if the situation had been reversed, they would have been upset for Europe. And so I feel a sympathy with the Americans because I can understand why they're frustrated. But I can also believe that had the situation been reversed, the Americans would have taken advantage of a ruling that was a little bit dodgy. But at the same time, I also think to myself that looking far more displaced about the whole thing, in an ideal world, everybody would be very moral. And the fact that the Europeans got a ruling that looked fantastic, and they say, well, the officials gave us that ruling, so we have to accept it. Well, if the officials had said Carlos Seganda could drop the ball 6 inches from the hole, they surely would have at that point said, oh, this is a bad ruling, we're not going to accept it. So you have to, there is always a line where you have to cross where you realise that the officials made a mistake. And they basically thought the line hadn't been crossed and thought they could get away with it. And I think that the body language and what the Europeans have said when they've tried to discuss the situation indicates to me that they feel a bit sheepish that they've got away with it. But I also think they think that the Americans would have accepted the same thing. I have no problem with that, but that's the sort of tit-for-tat way that sport works. I would have a big problem if they got very moralistic about it, because I think that modern sport isn't very moral, to be honest.
Yes, Thank you. On the ruling, mistakes are made. It's the time it took. And it's the momentum that it stopped. The momentum completely shifted. And to me, that was the unfair part of what happened yesterday.
And I also think it echoed down the matches as well. And America definitely had the momentum going, and it was a big change.
Yeah.
And so I have got a lot of sympathy for the Americans.
Now, what we've got this morning, though, is, or this evening, depending on what part of the world you are listening, it's amazing watching the ebb and flow of this event, day two foursomes. Anna Nordqvist, Caroline Hedwall, Morgan Pressel, Jessica Korda, they're all square. Avahara Munoz and Karina Shea, all square with Stacey Lewis and Paula Creamer. They were, Stacey Lewis and Paula Creamer were four up earlier, right? Katrina Mathieu and Caroline Masson, two up now on Brittany Lincecum and Lizette Salas are two up on Katrina Mathieu. Katrina Matthew's having a really tough Solheim Cup.
It's an interesting one. She came into this event along with Pettersson having the strongest record for the Europeans. But she's also sort of been... it's one of those strange things. Your record is almost determined a little bit by who you are partnered with. And a big pointer towards that is the fact that when I was looking at the stats at the start of the week, so many American golfers have their points record massaged by the fact they played with Paula Creamer, whose ability to win is just extraordinary prior to this week, at least. She didn't do so well yesterday and is in sort of reverse gear at the moment. But I think Brittany Lincecum, Christy Kerr, if they hadn't played with Paula Creamer at some point, their points record would be even worse than it is currently. And I think Katrina Mathieu has struggled a little bit because she's played twice yesterday with rookies who, I think Charlie Hull played quite well, but they were up against a team that played better than them. But certainly in the morning, she played with Jodie Ewers, who struggled a little bit. So I think the fact that she was this week, she's been deemed a veteran who will help the rookies, might possibly have been her downfall rather than anything that she's done herself.
We were talking with Ron Syrak earlier. You heard part of it. And we discussed the continent and how there's so many more people playing golf, Germany, France, Spain, being represented so much in the Solheim Cup. Do you think that the televised aspect of golf is spreading golf around the world?
I don't know about the televised nature of it, but definitely if you look at the amateur game in Europe, it is spreading quite considerably, especially to Eastern Europe. And I think when you consider that in a couple of years' time it'll be in Germany, I think Sandra Gahl presumably will sort of step up and hope to perform their return to the Solheim Cup. But there could also be, there's a young Czech player called Klára Spilková, who it wouldn't surprise me in the least if she gets into the team, because she's very young. It's one of those strange things that she now seems quite old compared to Charlie Hull. I think she's just 19, and she hasn't burst onto the scene, but she sort of quietly became a professional at quite a young age, and actually sort of quietly quite impressive, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if she contends to get into the team in a couple of years' time. And that kind of reflects the fact that... we've had a few Russians on the Ladies European Tour, but their youth teams are getting better, and definitely Poland is a nation that's getting a lot better. And if you look at the amateur game, more so in the men's a little bit, but definitely in the women's as well.
Now, what is the name of the young, the 19-year-old?
From the Czech Republic.
Yes.
She's called Klára Spilková, or Spilková, I'm not entirely sure of the pronunciation. But she did quite well in the British European Masters, which was the week before the Rico Women's British Open.
She's,
if you go on the Ladies European Tour, she features quite a bit in the photograph. Quite a good looking girl, which may or may not be a coincidence. Don't know.
Wait, look. Let me ask you one final question.
Yep.
As golf tipster for Betting Zone.
Yep.
What do you, how do you tip? What do you do? Tell us about that, because it's always fascinating. We're a wage-earning society.
Well, tipping about golf was actually my introduction to writing about it. I got interested in betting on golf, and somebody who worked for Betting Zone, you may follow him, Dave Tindall, who works for Sky Sports.
Yes.
And he got me involved because he saw that I was quite good at previewing events and predicting who would do quite well. So I got into it via that. And I don't do it so much now, but what I do is I try to apply the thought processes that good bettors use rather than sort of mug punters. I don't know if that phrase translates, but that's a phrase that's used in England for people who tend to just put 10 quid on their favourite player and hope for the best. But certainly golf's quite an intriguing game with its ability to, if you look closely at the statistics, you can sometimes discern patterns and discover that certain players are very good in certain circumstances, and they can be quite bizarre circumstances. I've been known to back a player on the basis that he plays better golf when the sea is in the background. And that might sound mental to some people, but there are definitely golfers who do perform better in those circumstances. And sometimes it's just more obvious ones, like people who are very good at playing links golf. Another example might be Søren Hansen. He's lost a lot of form on the European Tour now. But when he went through a period of being quite a good player, finishing top 40 in the European Tour Order of Merit quite frequently, his ability to actually peak on Jack Nicklaus designed golf courses was almost eerie. I think in his period when he played well on the European Tour, I think it was something like he had 10 top 10s on the trot on Jack Nicklaus designed golf courses, and normally he was more a sort of average to finishing top 40 type bloke. So it was quite a pronounced pattern there. That's the sort of thing I do. But also I do things like, to be more specific towards this week, Europe were quite obviously underdogs going into this week, and the biggest price you could back them was 7-2, which would probably translate as 4.5 in American odds. So it's a very large price, and although I wasn't convinced that they would win or could win, I was quite convinced a couple of years ago. Oh, by the way, there's a hole in one in the Solheim Cup, Anna Nordqvist.
Oh, by the way, while we're talking,
life story there for you. So Europe were quite a big price, and although history suggests they will do very badly in America, history also suggests that I think 10 times out of the last 11 occasions that the tournament's taken place, Europe have either been leading or tied going into the final day singles. What a canny bettor would do in those circumstances is back Europe at the beginning of the week, and then at some point later, knowing that the match would get tight, they could either back America or lay Europe, which is to back against Europe, and then effectively get a free bet on Europe. And if anybody had taken my advice, I was on a podcast on Tuesday discussing that subject. If you had actually backed Europe at 7-2 or 4.5 on Tuesday, they were odds on yesterday. So somebody could then have laid them and they'd have quite a nice position at the moment.
Thank you.
It's looking for little angles like that.
Matt Cooper, you know, I'm going to send people to Betting Zone and to follow you or follow you on Twitter to get more of this information. I have Steve Mona standing by, so I do have to make the transition.
I would just say one thing, Danielle. Yes. Probably the best place these days to get that sort of advice would be curiousaboutgolf.com.
Curious?
Curiousaboutgolf.com.
About golf. I'm writing this down. .com.
.com. And yeah, so that's the best place.
When you're doing your fantasy golf picks, if you're not a betting sort of person, go to curiousaboutgolf.com. Matt Cooper is the person we're talking with. You can follow him on Twitter at Matt Cooper Golf, and he's a lot of fun. Thanks for being on the show, Matt.
Okay, see you soon.
Yes, we will. We'll be back with Steve Mona right after this. My name is Danielle Tucker. This is The Golf Club.
Stay tuned. We'll be hitting the greens with Danielle Tucker when we return to The Golf Club.
Hoipu Bay on Kauai's South Shore. Come Share Our Home, where the Grand Slam was played. Robert Trent Jones Jr. saw the mountains and felt the sea. Sure, great vistas and greens most people only dream of. Take the day off or do business with a bunch of your best customers. Come join the fun and the aloha at Poipu Bay. Call us for your tea time, where great golf is played every day at Poipu Bay.
Hi, I'm Ernie Els. Autism now affects 1 in 88 children in the United States. Early diagnosis for autism makes all the difference. Please learn the early warning signs on our website, elsforautism.com, and talk to your doctor about an autism screening if you have any concerns. Autism is not game over, it is game on. Get educated and learn the facts. Please join me at the Els for Autism Golf Challenge this year. We are playing great courses throughout the United States. Fundraise $13,000 or more, and you can join me and some of my friends at the finale in Las Vegas. Thank you very much.
An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Call Star Protection Agency for your office building, shopping center, or construction site. Let Star Protection take care 24/7. They know what to do to protect your assets, or join the Star team. Need a threat and risk assessment for your business? Call 532-3911. 532-3911. Star Protection Agency, across Hawaii since 1991. Get Star Protection.
Ah, here's the local rule sign. Keep it in the fairway. It speeds up play. Now, back to Danielle Tucker.
Welcome back. Steve Mona, CEO, World Golf Foundation, his board of directors, Commissioner PGA Tour, Tim Fincham, Chief Executive for the RNA, Peter Dawson, Chief Executive European Tour, George O'Grady. It doesn't matter what names come after these titles. That's Executive Director, USGA, PGA of America, CEO, Executive Director of Augusta National, and the Commissioner, LPGA, who is Michael Wan, and he happens to be chairman of the board. Steve Mona, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Danielle. Great to be with you.
Now, you've got the nickname most, maybe it's not nickname, you were named the most powerful man in golf.
There's actually a listing of that, and there's about 36 people on the list. I was one of them, so I should not be confused with the most powerful, just on the list.
Okay. It's kind of like the sexiest guy, and there's a whole list of them. Most powerful man in golf, Steve Mona, on a list of several. Okay, now, the Solheim Cup, amazing what monies it generated for Ireland. What was it, $50 million?
That's right. It was almost $57 million for Ireland 2 years ago.
Wow. Now, how do they factor that? How do they figure that out?
Well, it's based on all of the different components that the tournament creates from an economic impact standpoint. So it's hotel rooms. It is the flights into and out of the host city, rental cars, restaurants, caterers, security, merchandise at the site. You name it. So it's every component of it and everything that having that tournament creates, both on a direct and indirect basis.
All right. So now, what do you think Denver, Colorado, or Colorado in general will benefit? How much do you think will come into that state because of this event, the Solheim Cup?
Well, let me put it this way. 4 years ago in Chicago, the number was $20 million. And then 2 years ago in Ireland, it was almost $57 million. I get asked why 57 versus 20. The answer is because in Ireland it was really a countrywide happening, if you will, and there was tremendous interest in it. Less so in the U.S. It's not a countrywide happening, obviously, but it's certainly a big event for the Denver area. So my guess is, because it hasn't been calculated yet, that it'll probably be about, I'd say, midway between the two. So in rough terms, probably in the 30 or so range is my guess where it'll come out.
I imagine that you also get that ripple effect, and that would be the people who see Ireland or, let's say, Colorado on television, and they say, you know, I need to go there in 6 months, next year. There's also that factor, right?
Absolutely. And if you consider Golf Channel has 30 hours of live coverage for the week, it's going to be broadcast, meaning the Solheim Cup, in 77 countries, representing almost 200 million households. So it's going to have a true global impact on Colorado golf. And the beyond that, and this really relates more back to the economic impact, but in previous years at major championships, there's actually documentation where businesses have relocated either headquarters or regional offices based on the experience that their executives had in a particular city at a particular major event. Now, I'm not predicting necessarily that's going to happen in this case, but I can assure you more people will be wanting to play golf in Colorado, and who knows, a company or two may want to do business there as a result of this tournament.
Wow. Now, could Hawaii, let's say, host a Solheim Cup?
Well, it's possible. the infrastructure needs are really what's significant. So just to give you some idea of scale in that regard, there'll be about 120,000 people attending the Solheim Cup during the course of this week. It takes about 1,600 volunteers to run the event. And it takes a pretty big infrastructure in terms of the golf course itself, but also the surrounding metropolitan area. Close to 10,000 hotel nights will be needed for the week. So it's just a question. There's no question that Hawaii's got the golf courses that can host it. The question is the infrastructure in place? Is the volunteer base in place, et cetera? And that would be one issue. Then the other, obviously, is the time difference with respect to television. But I think that could probably be managed. So the question is the infrastructure in place? If it is, then it probably could actually host it.
Yeah, yeah. The 120,000 people coming in, I think we could probably absorb them. It's finding
right.
the 1,600 volunteers that might
right.
be a challenge.
Right.
When we do events, the Sony Open, it generates a very, I think lots of volunteers come out, but not 1,600. And I'm not sure that we have, but still, it would be fun. A lot of people fly in from Canada, from the mainland. They come over just for the Sony Open. They make it their vacation. And that would be something, I imagine, that would be fun, too. But
oh, absolutely. Well, just on that point, Danielle, in the case of the Solheim Cup, four years ago, and I'm sure it'll be true this year, people from all 50 states attended. And 11 different countries actually were represented beyond the countries whose players represent those particular countries. So on that basis, I'm sure Hawaii would fare well because it's a place people would love to come. And I was with Mike Wan on Wednesday, and he told me that a lot of the spectators make this their annual golf trip of the year, or in this case, once every 4 years in the U.S., and it's something that they budget for and put all of their effort in terms of their annual vacation. So it's quite compelling in terms of the quality of the Solheim Cup that people would do that.
Yeah, and why did you, the reason I suggested Hawaii is because this is the first year the Solheim Cup has been held so far west. And I was
That's
wondering
right.
about the challenges. It seems like a pretty remote location, even though it's Denver. The course seems to be kind of distant. And I was wondering about the challenges, the electronic needs today to broadcast an event, the Wi-Fi requirements to support everybody who's broadcasting, you know, whether it's on Twitter, their internet, they're sending information back and forth. That's a huge demand. What do you do to boost up something that isn't there? I'm sure they don't have that at this golf course on a regular basis.
Well, it is suburban Denver. It's Parker, which and I was there on Wednesday this week. So from the Denver airport, it's probably about a half hour to the golf course, plus or minus. And it's part of that southern suburban area, and it's a very high-tech, savvy area. Lots of businesses there. So whereas the golf course looks remote, it's really just on the outskirts of a pretty large metro area. And because of that, all of the infrastructure needs are in place or close by. They can export what they need out to the golf course.
Mm.
So it ends up working okay for them. And like I said, the way it views on television probably is different than where it really lies in terms of the metropolitan area.
Okay. There were also some comments that there weren't maybe as the Wi-Fi wasn't necessarily as up to speed as some people would have liked it to have been. So I seemed even more remote with the view I had from television and the comments that I overheard.
Yeah.
Yes. So
and that could be. But like I said, it's right there in a metro area. So all those infrastructure needs should be getting met, is my guess.
So who makes the decision where the next Solheim Cup, or where, I'm sure the next one's planned, but who makes decisions about where the Solheim Cup will be played?
The LPGA Tour does that. Mike Wann as commissioner and his board makes those decisions. It is scheduled for 2 years. It'll be in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And then it is not yet scheduled for 4 years out in the United States. So they will be taking a hard look at that, I'm sure, after this year and probably making a decision. My guess is either later this year or probably early next year, because of all the planning that needs to happen.
Well, Steve Mona, the most powerful man in golf, at least he's on the list of 36. I'm just going to go with most powerful man in golf. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Likewise, Danielle. It's always good to be with you, and thanks for all you do for golf.
Absolutely. The CEO of the World Golf Foundation. Before you go, on growing the game, how are your efforts going? It seems to be working.
Well, I think that our efforts are working in the main. We have a very successful player development program called Get Golf Ready, which is bringing adults into the game at very rapid rates. We'll have 100,000 graduates of that program this year at about 4,000 certified facilities with about an 80% retention rate, meaning people will stay in the game after they go through the program. The First Tee obviously has been phenomenally successful. The youth development program bringing young people into the game. About 6 million people have been introduced to the game in the last dozen years or so through the First Tee. Now, having said that, we are facing some headwinds, obviously with uncertain economic times, although we're largely through those. The whole demands of time on people's schedule. So golf has to remain relevant and compelling to the kind of mainstream, if you will, of the population in order to be a game people will want to play and will want to dedicate their leisure time activity, both from a time and money standpoint. So we're working very hard. We were up about 6% in terms of rounds played last year. We were pleased with that. So the signals look good, but we have to work hard at it, no question about it.
Yeah, oh, good. Well, Turtle Bay and Ko'olina are two Get Golf Ready courses, if you're interested. They're really great programs, $99. I think it's six lessons. You're with four people or three people, and it's great. They give you everything that you need to know to get started and what to do to really build your game. It's a really good program. Steve Mona, CEO, World Golf Foundation. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Danielle. Appreciate it.
We'll be back right after this. My name is Danielle Tucker, and this is The Golf Club.
Stay tuned. We'll be hitting the greens with Danielle Tucker when we return to The Golf Club.
The new Acura RDX features an incredibly efficient V6 engine with 273 horsepower. Yet the RDX has incredible nimble driving characteristics. And let's not forget, it's also equipped with standard power moonroof, Bluetooth phone connectivity, and a 360-watt 7-speaker premium audio system. It also has standard leather seats. Unfortunately, they don't make any sound. Test drive the new RDX today.
Visit your local Acura dealer today. Luxury, intelligently priced.
The new Acura RLX's true sense of luxury comes from its unique technologies. From the Juuleye LED headlights and precision all-wheel steer to its available 14-speaker Krell premium audio system, the RLX takes everything you love about a luxury sedan and makes it even more luxurious. The all-new RLX from Acura. Luxury taken to a whole new level.
Visit your local Acura dealer today. Luxury, intelligently priced.
In the security business, trust is earned over time. That's why Star Protection Agency has grown to be the largest locally owned security company in Hawaii. We've earned a reputation as a common sense, highly responsive, cutting-edge security provider. Our clients know that we're watching out for them. We know that our fast response is what makes us a star performer.
And we'd like to thank our clients for their trust over the past 20 years.
Trust your security to the Star. Star Protection Agency.
Oh man, will you look at that? It's right down the fairway. What a beautiful shot. Oh man, can't be too happy about that one. Now, back to Danielle Tucker on The Golf Club.
right, we're back, and we're talking with Mike Trostel, the USGA curator and historian. He was golf program manager at ALS Therapy Development Institute. We're talking about the U.S. Amateur at the Country Club in Brookline, Massachusetts. Just to give you some background, you probably saw Mike on television during one of the segments, whether it was on Golf Channel or I guess it was on... Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Danielle. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We saw you on television during the Open, the U.S. Open, and you were on course with the white gloves handling the very beautiful pieces of art they really are now, the golf clubs from the past. And I got to tell you, Mike, okay, when I heard that the USGA curator and historian was going to be joining the program with facts about the U.S. Open, I was expecting sort of a mature, older gentleman. And Mike, you're young. How old are you? I've got to ask you.
Danielle, I'm 29 years old. I may be mature beyond my years, but I'm 29.
What got you into the historian, being the curator at the USGA?
Well, you know, as a history major in college, I went down to the College of William & Mary, and a great place for history, and I started as an intern at the museum. And at the time, the USGA Museum, a golf museum, is in Far Hills, New Jersey, and the museum was closed for renovation. So what I got to do is write really the first draft of all the text that when you go into the museum and you see it and you read it on the walls. That was what I got to do as an intern. So it was a really cool job, and I loved it. It was supposed to be a couple months. Turned out to be closer to a year. I moved back up to Boston for a little bit, worked up there, as you mentioned, for the ALS Therapy Development Institute, and then came back to the USGA about 4 years ago. It's been a fun, really fun journey for me.
I personally am fascinated by history, wanted to be an archaeologist, and in a way, the way you handle everything that's in the museum, you have to treat it as an artifact, as something that needs to be protected. We saw you with the white gloves. Why are those gloves so necessary when you're handling, like, Calamity Jane, for instance, the putter that Bobby Jones used when he won the 1930 Grand Slam?
Yeah, as you mentioned, we had the white gloves and a couple of the probably the most significant clubs in our collection down at Marion this year for the U.S. Open. We had Calamity Jane and Ben Hogan's one iron. And the reason for the white gloves is really for proper museum practices. You know, it's the oils on your hands, anything that could break down the club structure. You might think, oh, it's not that big of a deal, but, you know, the clubs that we'll be talking about today, again, we brought a few clubs from Francis Ouimet from back in 1913 to the Country Club, and they would probably not be in such good shape, you know, if people were just handling them with bare hands. So it's just to keep oils off the clubs and keep the clubs as clean and preserved as possible for future generations.
Well, you know, when I was watching television, I saw the guys, you actually allowed them to have it on their set, you know, and they were trying to figure out how to touch it. I thought, oh, be careful, careful. They weren't really using their... I can imagine that you know, kind of like as a proud papa of all these things, you know, you are in charge, and that would give you pause if somebody doesn't handle it correctly. But you're now at the Country Club in Brookline, Massachusetts. Now, do I understand correctly that in 1913, Francis Ouimet won the U.S. Amateur there?
He actually won the U.S. Open there in 1913. That was, the big event. It was probably the most important event in American golf history, the most significant event, you know, because at the time, golf had only been in the United States for about 25 years. So Ouimet wasn't the first American to win the U.S. Open, but it's really who he beat. He beat Harry Vardon and Ted Ray, who were two of the best players in the game at the time, over from Britain, from the U.K., and they were on a tour here to kind of popularize the game and a few of the products that they were endorsing on a tour. And the fact that Ouimet, who was a 20-year-old amateur who grew up right across the street from the 17th hole of the Country Club at 246 Clive Street, the house is still there.
Wow.
The fact that he was able to come over and beat those two guys in a playoff, essentially head-to-head, was truly remarkable, and it was an inspiring story. Guys like Bob Jones and Walter Hagen and Gene Sarazen in the future, they, you know, well, Hagen was playing in the event, just missed the playoff, but the other two were caddies and growing up, and they were very much inspired by Ouimet's story, and it helped erode the perception that golf was a game for the elite classes, which at the time, at the turn of the century, that's really what it was viewed as. You know, it wasn't a blue-collar game at all, and Ouimet helped to break that down a little bit And in the decade after we met to win, more than 2 million Americans picked up the game. It went from about 350,000 to more than 2.5 million.
Wow, that is amazing. And, you know, there was a movie. Was that the movie, is the name of which, of course, escapes me right now?
Yeah, it's it was a book by Mark Frost called The Greatest Game Ever Played, and then it became a movie a couple of years later. And it's one of those stories that, you know, truth is much stronger than fiction sometimes. And it's, you can't make this stuff up. A 10-year-old caddy is carrying his bag. A kid who skipped school, a truant officer, came by to his family and warned him that little Eddie Lowry had missed school. And Eddie still skipped again. And some of the members of the country club told Francis we met, hey, you know, let's get you a real caddy for this playoff. You know, you've done unbelievable so far with Eddie, but let's get you some real help. And, you know, Eddie said, no, I want to carry the bag. And Francis said, you know, the kid's been great so far, so let's keep doing it for the last 18 holes. And you just can't make this stuff up. It's a really cool story. And one, for myself, I grew up in Massachusetts, one that really got me involved in the game of golf.
Fabulous. It is. And so the movie does hold to the truth of the story.
It does. Yeah, it's a great movie. It came out, I'd say, probably about 7 or 8 years ago now. And it's a great story that really transcends. It's not just about golf. It's about American culture and living the American dream. It has a little bit of that Horatio Alger story in it, too.
Yeah, breaking through. I mean, when he goes into the dance the night before, you know, or the event where everybody, it was like coming out parties for the girls. You know, they're all dressed up and he's obviously feeling underdressed and overwhelmed to a degree by all of the pomp and circumstance and having people look down their noses at him. And he carries it off so well in the movie. And I imagine Francis we met was able to do the same if he's going on to win the U.S. Open as he did it at the country club. Now we've just had the U.S. Amateur and it's being played. The final is being played today. And is the course the same as it was then, or have they made a lot of changes to the country club?
Well, it certainly made some changes, but I think, you know, for the most part, it's on the same parcel of land. So when these guys are going around, or they have gone around this week, it probably gives them goosebumps. I talked to a few of the players during stroke play, and, you know, it's pretty cool. It's not just Francis we met, but it's the place where our last U.S. Open was won back-to-back. Curtis Strange won the first of two back-to-back U.S. Opens there in 1988, where the famous Ryder Cup was won, the great comeback on the final day with the ugly shirts when Justin Leonard made that putt in the 17th hole from the front of the green. But the course itself has changed a little bit over time. I think that, you know, as distance and equipment has evolved, it's necessitated some of those changes. But you know, for the most part, the course is structurally the same, and it's a very challenging course for those players now. I know in stroke play, I think 144 was the cutoff, four over par, so it certainly challenged the best amateurs in the world out there.
Yes. I love the fact that you were quoted in a story by the Boston Globe. I like to tell stories. I like to see the looks on people's faces when they hear something they didn't know before, and it truly is. It's like teaching and passing on information that's hidden away in a place that a lot of people don't go to, and you get to make it come alive. And I think your youth adds to that. It becomes infectious. I really like that. Can you tell us some of the, maybe a story that you remember telling someone and how that impacted them?
Sure. I think one of the ones that was pretty cool is John Peterson, the pro who went to LSU, and he had a great performance in the 2012 U.S. Open at the Olympic Club. Got a hole-in-one in the final round and was threatening the lead. Now, he was down at Marion. He didn't have to qualify this year because of his top-five finish. And he's from Texas. He grew up down there. And I had Hogan's one-iron with me with the white gloves doing an interview with Golf Channel, just talking about the history of Marion Golf Club. And he came over. He's like, is that Hogan's one-iron? And he had never heard the story about how the one-iron disappeared. So Hogan used it, of course, in the final round of the 1950 U.S. Open. Hit it under the final green, the 72nd hole, made a par, forced the playoff. But the club disappeared between the final round of the playoff. And it was gone for 33 years till a golf club collector found it. I gave it to Lanny Watkins, who gave it to someone who worked for the Hogan Corporation at the time, and eventually got back to Ben, and he said, yeah, this is it. This is the one iron that I hit at Marion in 1950. And he gave it to the museum. And John Peterson, as a Texas native and someone who's always looked up to Hogan as a hero, thought that was just like the coolest thing. And, you know, you hear a lot of times these days that athletes don't necessarily appreciate their predecessors and the history of the game in all sports. But yeah, I learned that to really not be the case, at least when it came to some of these iconic artifacts like the Hogan One Iron.
Absolutely. I was fascinated just looking at him on the television set. I can't imagine, you know, just being right there close up. You've written a book with Robert Williams, the museum's director, The Greatest Moments in U.S. Open History. What's the book title, and give us a little bit of information from it that we might like to pick it up?
Yeah, the book is called Great Moments of the U.S. Open, and it's available at the USGA website, usga.org, and also online at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And really one of the reasons that we wrote the book was for the story we were just talking about, the Francis we met 1913 U.S. Open victory, being the centennial this year. That victory was one that really was the jump-off point for American golf. So what we did is highlighted, I think it ended up being 27 great moments of the U.S. Open. And we went into our archives and found great pictures, great stories, some of the artifacts that we have on display in our museum. And put that into a coffee table size book, 10 by 10, going through 113 years of the U.S. Open history. So it's definitely worth picking up. And if you're a golf fan, I think you'll really love it.
And Christmas is right around the corner, people. This is like
absolutely
a beautiful present for Christmas. You know, you travel around the world. You interviewed George W. Bush. He gave you a little bit of heat for not wearing green on St. Patty's Day.
Yeah, it was St. Patrick's Day. We did a golf and politics exhibit when the U.S. Open was at Congressional in 2011, and I was lucky enough to interview President Bill Clinton, and then went down to Texas and interviewed President George W. Bush. And yeah, he gave us a hard time. I had packed for the trip. It was a week-long trip, and I wasn't even thinking it was going to be St. Patrick's Day. I didn't have any green on, and he gave me a hard time, but couldn't have been nicer and very thoughtful about the game. Someone who gave up the game of golf when he was a president, and I think that was, you know, it was hard to do, but he's definitely come back in full spirits here in the last couple of years, and enjoys playing the game very much with Condoleezza Rice and some other members down in Dallas.
The ALS Therapy Development Institute, I'm fascinated. I did not know that they would have a golf program manager.
Yeah, I guess the simplest way to explain it was there were two parts of our organization. I was on the operations team, and I was the golf program manager and ran 50 to 60 events across the country that raised money, anywhere from, you know, a few thousand dollars at some tournaments to some of the bigger ones. There were several hundred thousand dollars, and all the money that we raised went toward research to find some sort of cure or treatment for ALS, for Lou Gehrig's disease. And there was a science side that we're constantly working on that. So we worked in a lab. There were probably about six or seven of us on the operations team, and all the money we made went to the scientists to fund their experiments. So it was a very rewarding couple of years when I was up there in Boston doing that.
I bet. Fun talking with you.
The Walker Cup is going to be going to National Golf Links coming up another month. That'll be a lot of fun.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about the history of the Walker Cup.
Yeah, the Walker Cup was started in 1922. It was actually started by George Herbert Walker, who is a descendant, or excuse me, is part of the lineage of the George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush family, the presidents of the United States. And it was started as really something, an event to be had among goodwill among nations between the European nations and the American nations coming out of World War One. And a great event. It's now played biennially. And if people maybe haven't heard of it, it's very similar to the Ryder Cup format. The best amateurs in the world go head-to-head and force in this four-ball and singles. And this year we'll be going back to the National Golf Links of America on the tip of Long Island, where the very first Walker Cup was played back in 1922. So it should be really special to be back there. Great course out there on the tip of Long Island.
I think what's important is what you said at the very beginning. It was started after World War One to foster relations between countries, European and U.S.
It wasn't necessarily, I mean, it normally was some of the best players, but it wasn't cutthroat competition as you may see in some of the open or amateur championships. It was really, to foster goodwill among the nations and to help the rebuilding effort. And it was the dinner before, they toast to the president, they toast to either the king or queen, whatever it's been over the years. In talking to some of the players who have played in it, over the past several decades, it's the friendships that come out of that. Obviously, teams are playing to win, but there's so much more that you can get out of this competition, and that's what we've seen over the past several decades with the Walker Cup.
I love golf for all the reasons you brought up, for the history of the game, for the fostering of goodwill between people, for the friendships that develop. It's just, it's wonderful. And for the charity, you know, the funds that are raised to do things like the ALS research. Thank you, Mike Trostel, USGA curator and historian, for being on my show, The Golf Club. I really appreciate your time.
Danielle, thanks for having me.
We'll be back. My name is Danielle Tucker. This is The Golf Club.
Stay tuned. We'll be hitting the greens with Danielle Tucker when we return to The Golf Club.
It was our office manager's birthday, and she loves golf. So we decided to get together for golf at Poipu Bay, and we invited a bunch of our customers. It turned into a party. The clubhouse restaurant made a fabulous lunch. The customers had a great time and met the people they give orders to. They were golf buddies long before the 19th hole. Golf at Poipu Bay. Family, friends, business, and fun at Poipu Bay Golf Course on Kauai's South Shore. Spectacular. Call 742-8711 and book your tee time, get together, or event at Poipu Bay. That's 742-8711. Poipu Bay Golf Course, Kauai's South Shore Gem.
Wow, what a beautiful day. Let's go back in the clubhouse and listen to Danielle Tucker.
And welcome back, and we have to do one bit of business here. KPUA Hilo, KGU Honolulu, KONI Lanai City, KTOH Kalaheo. That's for the FCC. And now, for fun, Matt Janella, Golf Channel co-host. Matt Janella is the travel editor for Golf Channel. He covers courses, resorts, avid amateurs. Morning Drive, you got to watch it, or set your DVR. It's so much fun. Where to play if you're watching Solheim Cup, and it's so riveting right now. I'm surprised you're listening. But I know yesterday I didn't have a television, so. And maybe the Bubble Boys, maybe the U.S. Amateur. So much history is being made. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Danielle. Always like talking to you.
Oh, it's so much fun. I was looking at, you know, I was thinking, boy, wouldn't it be something if an Englishman won the U.S. Amateur? It hasn't been done since, like, 1917 or something. And, numbers start getting crossed in my mind about this time of the day. It's at the Brookline, you know, Country Club in Brookline, Massachusetts. Many historic events have been played there. And so, sure enough, yesterday I'm paying attention to the Solheim Cup, and we have an Aussie, a Canadian, an Englishman, another Aussie. It looks like we're down to Matthew Fitzpatrick of England and Oliver Goss of Australia going for the U.S. Amateur. There's nobody from the United States of America in the event. That's never happened before.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, right? I mean, and it's probably caused for concern. I mean, the U.S. Amateur, the winner of the U.S. Amateur, it seems like there's been a significant decline of the impact since, you know, Tiger was winning it, of the person who wins it to the person, you know, for people going on and having big careers on the PGA Tour for whatever reason. And I wonder if that's because of the match play format in the end. I don't know. I don't know why.
It's interesting. I think that you get in by stroke play, then it's match play.
Yeah.
Do they play college match play more often? I don't think so. It seems like right. So, but they do play.
And also, they're going more. They're going pro quicker now. I mean, there's so much money. It doesn't make sense to stay an amateur as long as you might. That someone would play, you know, way back when, you know, before Tiger came to the scene.
Which brings up, you know, when we talk about the major, back in the day when Bobby Jones was playing as an amateur, that was, the professionals were looked down upon. A professional golfer? You're nobody. I'm an amateur. I'm so rich, I can just play golf. And the amateurs... the amateurs were the cream of the crop, and the professionals like just under your feet. So
it's a whole different time. Yeah.
Yes, it's completely changed. But what does happen in Europe is they play a lot more match play There's a lot more match play being played over there, and not as many guys are going amateur because they don't have the PGA Tour luring them, and they're not being groomed the way that we groom these young guys in college. You know, if they're noticed, the equipment companies start looking at them, the clothing companies, the sports trainers, and the, you know, swing coaches and the putting gurus, and they start developing a team, and pretty soon, the dollars, it's big dollars, big dollars. The other thing that's happening this weekend is on the PGA Tour, the Bubble Boys. And did your guy, did you pick somebody that you thought would get their job for the next 2 years at least?
I think I said Greg Chalmers was the guy I was watching just because he was on the line of both FedEx Cup points and PGA Tour money. I was flying yesterday up northeast, and I've been doing a shoot all day today, so I've lost track. I can't tell you how he did. I think he had a decent first round. He didn't shoot himself in the foot, so I don't know what he did in the second round.
I like that. When you're so out, it's like yesterday I was completely out of touch. And then when I did see the very end, I managed to see the 15, the rules situation at the Solheim Cup. That was interesting. But tell us, with all the Solheim Cup attention focus, and I was talking to Steve Mona about the economic benefits. The Colorado area, the Denver area, will benefit from people wanting to go there and play golf. Where do you recommend they go play?
I just did a travel segment on Denver. I did a story on the caddy program, the summer caddy program, Solich Caddy Academy, Leadership Academy. This week on Morning Drive, it all takes place at Common Ground, which is a Tom Doak renovated golf course not too far from downtown Denver. And this is an old military course that Doak converted to what was ultimately the companion course to the U.S. Amateur at Cherry Hills last year. So it's a legitimate golf course, and you can play it for less than $50. It reminds me a little bit of Wailua, you know what I mean? It's that kind of good muni-ish feel. It's a good place for locals, but a great place if you're just flying in and out of Denver. And they've got this subsidized caddy program. So during the summer, if you go there, you can take a caddy for free. These great kids of modest means that they've plucked out of their situation and given them a job, and all you have to do is sort of commit to talking to this kid about life's lessons, and you can give a tip at any price that you feel is fair, and I just think it's brilliant. They're going to have 58 kids going through the program by the end of this summer, in the first two summers, and it's really designed to be a feeder system to other caddy programs in the Denver area, at other courses in the Denver area, and ultimately into what is the Evans Scholarship Program. They have their first Evans Scholars out of this caddy program already, and I think they'll have another one next year.
That is so good to hear. Excellent.
Yeah, it's good for the game. Good for the game, good for kids, good for people. Physical fit, walking is better than riding. Just makes sense on so many levels. It was a story I wanted to tell for over a year back in the days that I was at Golf Digest and didn't get a chance to, and now really excited to go back out there and tell the story on Morning Drive.
We're talking with Matt Janella, travel editor for Golf Channel, and covers courses, resorts, and avid amateurs for Golf Channel's Morning Drive. You watch him at Hawaii. It's like 3 o'clock. No, 1 o'clock in the morning, 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. But I just put it on DVR. I catch your second one. At 3 o'clock when I get up. 3 a.m.
So funny. I get your tweets. I'm like, what is Danielle doing up? The funny thing is I go to work at 2:45 in the morning, and it's about a 20-minute drive. And the first thing I do when I get in the car, I call my brother who lives on the north shore of Oahu. And it's like, 9:45 at night over there. And so I catch up with my brother, the day before, and before he's gone to bed, and I've already woken up. I'm going to work in the morning. It's pretty funny.
That's great. That's great. We both share a love for Kahuku, that golf course. And I've heard somebody talking about actually acquiring that piece of property and turning it into an 18-hole course. You've heard this too.
I don't think I'm free to say who it is.
No, neither one of us is.
I know that if the person gets this, that they're very excited about the possibilities.
Yes.
And hopefully they keep it as affordable as it is now. I just think it's one of the greatest stories of value golf in the United States.
It is. At Kahuku, if you get a chance, when you're driving up, you go along the Windward Coast, or if you're at Turtle Bay, you come down toward Kahuku Town. After the sugar mill, you'll see the high school. It'll be on your right, and there's a little street that you go down on your left, and you think, I'm not going anywhere. Well, you just keep driving, and all of a sudden, you go across a sand dune, and wow, there's a golf course. It's like, okay.
Yeah. People are in bare feet, and sometimes shirts, and it's just, but it's all that's right with affordable and accessible golf. It's the same coastline that you only see a little bit when you're playing the Palmer course at Turtle Bay. You actually get more holes along the coastline by far than you do at the Palmer course at Turtle Bay.
Yes.
And on a windy day, that might not necessarily be a virtue, but you still get great scenery.
Yes. Yeah. Gabby Pahinui, one of the greats in Hawaiian music, used to play Kahuku's turtle, Kahuku Muni, and barefoot all the time. He actually passed away there. He had a heart attack while he was playing golf on the course. So it's a
we should all be so lucky.
Yes, precisely my thought. Okay, now I just checked on Greg Chalmers. Okay,
yeah,
your man had a 69-69, starting the day tied for 38. Pretty good. Nice
good,
pick.
Good.
Yes.
Now, I like it.
Have you had any chance to catch up on the Solheim Cup?
I just walked outside. I was grabbing lunch, and I walked outside to make this call, and I was listening to your last interview, so I lost track of what was taking place. I can't believe Kramer and Lewis relinquished that lead. They were so hot so early. And then I saw a hole-in-one to end that European match.
Yes.
How's Michelle Wee doing? I made a big statement on Morning Drive that I thought the pick was justified. I like the Michelle Wee pick. She's good for chemistry. She played well in 2011. I think she was poised to contribute. She seems to care a lot about it. She's still, like Paige McKenzie said on Morning Drive, she's still considered one of the top five best talents on the LPGA Tour. So I think the team event kind of frees her up to be a golfer again and not so mechanical. So I thought it was good, and she went out and backed me up and got that point yesterday.
Absolutely awesome. Today I didn't understand the Michelle Wee Brittany Lang combination quite as much.
Right.
As Chrissy Kerr is perfect. But Anna Norquist and Caroline Hedwall and Morgan Pressel and Jessica Corder, that match is over. Caroline won 2-1, and Europe 6 points to the U.S. 3 points. Everybody said that they were going to have to finish, the Europeans would have to be very strong in these four-ball foursomes so that they can go into singles. I don't think anybody expected them to be this strong. We've got Azahar Munoz and Karini Shea all square with Stacey Lewis and Paula Creamer. Katrina Matthew, and Caroline Masson, one up. Brittany Lincecum and Lizette Salas, one up over Katrina Matthew and Caroline Masson, okay? And Michelle Wee and Brittany Lang, one up over Suzanne Paterson and Beatrice Riccari. So
that would be a big win right there.
Huge.
Yeah, they need these three. They need these three go in 6-6 into the afternoon. That would be a big morning for the U.S.
Yes, huge. So we're all square in one, and two, we lead one. So things are fabulous. And I've got to start the show with you so we can just continue talk as long as we want. When you're not in the middle, I'm about to end the show. Can you give us like a tease of what you're going to cover from the New York area?
I'm going to be, believe it or not, if for people who hate me because I have a desirable job, they're really going to hate me. I'm driving around in a brand new BMW that hasn't been released. I'm hitting all the famous New York sites on my way to Liberty National, and I'll do the same to all the four FedEx Cup destinations.
Okay, fine. We don't like you anymore, Maddie. Bye. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for having me.
Matt Janella. See him on Morning Drive on Golf Channel. I want to thank our sponsor to make this show possible, Star Protection, for property threat and risk assessment. Protect your home. Get them there to assess the risk and then protect it. Or your concert, your special event, doesn't matter. Hyundai Tournament of Champions. Get the star team on your property. Star Protection is what you need in Hawaii. Poipu Bay Golf Course, 18 championship holes. It's stunning, and you don't have to be really, really good. Tee it forward. Hey, it's an unforgettable golf experience, and it's called Poipu Bay, Kauai's South Shore gem. And, of course, Acura of Honolulu, now more than ever, choosing an Acura just makes sense. With this much traffic, you should ride in comfort. The Acura RLX and RLX Advance. Test drive that car. Thank you for your mana. May you hit the sweet spot every time. I'm Danielle Tucker, and this is The Golf Club.
You've been listening to the award-winning Golf Club Radio Show with Danielle Tucker on the Golf Club Network statewide. Tune in next week, and we'll tee it up together only on the Golf Club.
Copyright 2013.